FBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 9, Episode 2. In this week's case of, we covered the case of Ivan Cantu. Ivan is in the state of Texas. He's on death row. He was convicted in 2001 for the murder of his first cousin and his cousin's girlfriend. There's many people out there that believe that Ivan was wrongfully convicted. He has exhausted his appeals. And if new evidence is not discovered or presented, allowed to be presented to the courts, Ivan will at any time be executed. We had on the podcast Matt Duff from the Cousins by Blood podcast and Liz Rose, who's also blogging about the case. And they gave us a lot of information. We're going to talk about a little bit more. I got a bunch of questions from you, and I got Zach and Mike in the studio with me to help us answer them.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, our first question comes from Michelle. This whole story was very confusing. I'm not sure what happened according to whom because the narrative was all jumbled. Can we get a brief, quote, prosecutor says and defense says rundown?
Well, let me just fill you guys in on kind of scheduling for us. You shouldn't notice a blip in any of this because we've taken steps to make sure that all of our episodes are published the same normal time they always are. But we've been talking about, you know, for the last several months that Mike and I, for his bachelor party, are going out to Wyoming for a week-long camping and hunting trip. That's next week. And then the next week is Mike's wedding. So in order to accommodate those, we've had to record a bunch of episodes all in advance. I'm only telling you guys that to tell you this, that next week's follow-up is going to be a little bit different because we have to record it this week before the episode even drops. But I think we've got that covered. But as far as like some of these questions, I'm going to do my best. I tried to brush back up on things, but in all honesty, I have recorded 7 interviews about 7 different cases in 2 weeks. So I'm trying to unscramble myself. That won't be the norm going forward, but just to prepare for this. So that being said, the Ivan Cantu case, the state's theory is that Ivan went to his cousin's house, shot and killed him and his girlfriend. And with an apparent motive of robbery, because they're saying there was money stolen, there was a Rolex stolen, there was a diamond engagement ring stolen. And then he goes back home, and the state's theory is based largely on his girlfriend, Amy Betcher's testimony. If I said it wrong before, it was Amy Kitchen was the victim. There's 2 Amys. But so then the state's theory is that after he shoots his cousin and his girlfriend, he gets in their car. At some point, I'm not real clear because there's a lot of back and forth with the cars, but he goes back to his apartment and tells his girlfriend, Amy B, that he had just murdered them. And then she says, in an attempt to intimidate her, takes her back over to the crime scene where he just murdered, double homicide, shot 2 people, takes her back over there and shows her the bodies. They gather up more stuff. I think that's what she says. He grabs the Rolex and the ring and things. And then also Amy says that when he came home after the initial trip, the murder, that he had blood on his pants and blood on his socks. And there's no question that he did it because he told her he did it. And then he showed her the bodies and they took some stuff and then they leave. And then they go out cruising around to bars in the victim, James's Corvette. And they go bar hopping. They're drinking, doing some drugs. And then the next day, It's been proven they had a pre-planned trip to go to Amy's parents' house in Arkansas the next day. So the next morning, they get up, leave the Corvette, which is the victim's Corvette, right outside the front door of Ivan's apartment. Ivan takes off his bloody socks and his bloody pants and throws them on the top of his trash can in his kitchen. And then they, while they're around the bar that night too, to back up a little, they're telling everyone that they just decided to get engaged, and Amy's showing off this new diamond ring that Ivan had just got her, which is supposedly actually the victim, Amy Kitchen's ring that she's wearing. They go to her parents' house. Her dad says she's a little freaked out. She's a little scary. They tell her parents that they got engaged. They show the ring off there. And then that's when the police start looking for Ivan, because they found the bloody pants, and they found the car outside of his apartment. And so they bring him and arrest him. Seems very, very cut and dry. I mean, the victim's car's at his house. The bloody pants, which DNA evidence later proved had the victim's blood on it, was found in his trash can. The ring was stolen. They were seen by multiple people with the ring. And then there's also, when they come back from Arkansas, they go to Ivan's ex-girlfriend's house and spend the night there. And after they leave, Amy tells the ex-girlfriend, as the ex-girlfriend's taking her to the airport, which is all this is very, you got to listen to the podcast for all the long details about this, but Ivan gets arrested, and then Ivan's ex-girlfriend takes his current girlfriend to the airport, and she gives her $1,500 and says, go back to your apartment, make sure that Ivan didn't leave anything there under the couch cushions. She goes back, looks under the couch cushions, and sure enough, there's some drugs and money, and I think there was money, but in the murder weapon, the pistol that was used to kill the two victims was found under the couch, which was the final piece of evidence. Ivan was there, and now the murder weapon was stashed at her house. Seemed like a very cut and dry case. Now, the defense side of it, or actually I'll say the reality of it is, if you start breaking these things down, the first place where things start to crumble is when the police, after they find James dead and Amy Kitchen dead, the police go to Ivan's with his mother to notify him what happened. And they're worried about him because his cousin, while he had a business that involved mortgages, he was also supposedly a known drug dealer and like large quantities, like had a lot of money as a drug dealer. And they're worried that Ivan might be connected to some of this. So they go to his house. Two officers go into the house. They search the house. Ivan's not there. One of the officers was interviewed on the Cousins by Blood podcast and said the place was neat and tidy. There was nothing out of place. There was no, you know, they certainly would have seen bloody jeans on top of a trash can. None of that was present. And they also didn't notice the Corvette that the next day when the search warrants executed that was found parked right outside the door. Now, they can't say the Corvette wasn't there, but they can say they don't recall seeing it. They didn't notice it. And it'd be something because they knew the Corvette was missing. You'd think they might have caught onto. So all of a sudden, this starts to look sketchy. And then when we get pictures of the actual bloody pants, remember Amy says when Ivan comes home, he's wearing these pants, they're covered in blood, and the socks are covered in blood. The actual evidence photos of the pants, it's like down around the cuff of the pants, there are just a couple drops. Like there's no way you would notice that when somebody walks in. It's not like there was blood all over. A couple drops around the cuffs of the pants was the only blood. So that's a problem. It's also a problem that the pants are two sizes too big for Ivan. And then there's just the very kind of logical thing of, if you committed these murders and you're trying to get away with it, why would you park the victim's car right outside your house and then put the bloody clothing right on top of the trash can where it could be easy to be found? And then the ring, if you stole a wedding ring from somebody who was just murdered, does it make sense then to put the ring on your girlfriend? And it's not like he's tricking his girlfriend, because he's told his girlfriend that the murders happened and then supposedly puts this ring on her and has her go around showing it off to people, showing everybody that you know, look at this ring I gave her, which would obviously point right back to him. So very quickly, everything starts to fall apart. And then there's also the red Corvette. So Amy says they leave, and I don't remember the times off the top of my head, but they left at a particular time to go to Arkansas. And Ivan says they left at a different time the next morning. But in either scenario, there's a toll tag where the Corvette drove through a toll road stop, you know, where they have got the, you know, they scan your license or whatever as you go through it. Like, I want to say like 11 in the morning after the murders, which in by both scenarios, Ivan's and Amy B's, they're gone on their way to Arkansas by then. Like neither of their stories line up with that, which could be an indicator that someone else moved the car and put it at Ivan's house after they were out of town. So the long and short of it is there's not, you can't say here's a bunch of evidence that proves Ivan is innocent. What you have is here's all the evidence that says he's guilty. And when you look at every piece of that evidence, it all crumbles and falls apart. But this is not a case where, and I said that on the podcast, that you know, we see a lot of cases where with potential wrongful convictions where what we're seeing are corrupt prosecutors and there was some corrupt prosecution here that we'll get into, I'm sure. But, you know, corrupt police officers that are fabricating evidence. To me, in my opinion, that wasn't the case here. If Ivan Cantu is innocent, then he was very clearly set up. You know, the police didn't plant bloody pants at his house, but if Ivan didn't do it, somebody did. And the police didn't put the Corvette in front of his house, but if Ivan didn't do it, somebody did. So it looks more the case. I mean, the police, from what I can see, followed a logical path that led to the arrest of Ivan Cantu. But what they failed to see, if this is what happened, is that it's very possible that someone else planted all of this evidence in order to set him up.
I appreciate you summing that up because I really came out of this episode with a lot of questions myself. And I think you covered a lot of it, which is nice. A couple of things that was talked about. So Matt talked about that Ivan was pretty wealthy at one point and had lost all his wealth. Do we know how that occurred? Was it through, because he talked about maybe getting divorced. Did it happen through the divorce?
You know, I'm not exactly sure about that. As I remember correctly, he at one point was working for his cousin selling mortgages. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he was in pretty good shape. It sounds like he did have some drug problems. I'm not exactly sure what happened to his wealth, but I think you're right. I think there was a point where he was very financially stable,
mm-hmm.
and then it came to a point where he wasn't. And I know it does say it in the podcast, in the Cousins by Blood podcast. I just can't remember what it is. But at the time of these murders, he was actually working two jobs. I think he might have been doing the mortgage. I think he was doing the mortgage broker job, and then he had another part-time job because he was trying to dig himself out of a hole that he had put himself into.
And then one other thing you mentioned was the pants, the bloody pants in the trash can.
Uh-huh.
Is there any chance, like in theory, that they could have been moved to the top four photos? Like if the crime scene analyst came in to look at it or whatever when they're photographing? Because, you know, the first, when they come in for the wellness check, they don't see him.
Right.
But then when they come in to find him, I'm not saying that it wasn't planted, but is there a possibility that it could have been, you know, they could have seen them and kind of moved them so they could get a better photo?
Yeah, you can never say there's not a possibility. But mm-hmm. I don't see evidence here that the police department or the lead detective was really doing anything shady. And so I would say the probability is very, very low because, okay. you know, because then you're corrupting the evidence. So, the photos they're taking that they've taken of them, the process is you take a photo of it as it sits, take close-ups of it as it sits, take photos of the same thing we would do in an arson investigation all the way around it, and then you would remove it and take more photos and then package it and then take more photos the way around it. So there's no reason for them to say it was right on top because they had a valid search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they had found them during like the welfare check and they're trying to pull a fast one, then that's when you might expect like, oh, they said they were on top, but they weren't because they didn't have a search warrant. So like if they were digging through the trash and found them, like, shit, we just found these, but it's kind of fruit of the poisonous tree. Like, we're not supposed to be searching here, so this now we can't use this evidence. So let's just say we saw it sitting on top. But in this case, they went back with a valid search warrant and found him. So I don't think that's the case. I think they were actually sitting on top of the trash.
And that makes sense to me. One of the things that I'm a little confused about too is Amy B, the girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
of her just like completely turning on him almost at a moment's notice. Seems strange to me. Like, maybe she's got something to do with it, maybe she doesn't, but it just seems strange to me that you would pin it on your boyfriend or your fiance if they're right. saying they're engaged so quickly. And, you know, with the story with the bullet, how they got an argument, he came out and fired around at her,
right,
into the wall. And then his story says there was a Domino's delivery driver.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, it seems that's all really strange to me.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a minute. So what you have is Amy handing him to the police.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just telling everything. And what we learn later is she's even telling them things that aren't true to make him look more guilty. And then the story, we didn't really get on the podcast, we didn't get too much into the Domino's delivery guy, did we?
They talked about it briefly.
Yeah.
That Ivan said that there was a person dressed up as a Domino's delivery guy.
Right. that had come in a few days before and threatened him.
Yeah, saying that his cousin owed drug money, I believe, is the reason.
He didn't say drug money, but I think he assumed that. I think he said that he owed him money and he had so much time to pay or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the guy like had him down on his knees in the apartment, pointing a gun at him, and then fired a shot into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then Amy says that they were fighting and Ivan had a gun and fired it into the wall.
Yeah.
Which may be true. And I feel like there's another story out there that it was like an accidental discharge that it got fired into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But so when you think about that, if look at the scenario, you also have Amy acting as though she's telling people she's afraid of Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
You also have Amy, after Ivan is arrested, leaving because she's scared something's going to happen to her. Now, if the story she told is true, Ivan acting alone, based solely out of greed, went and killed his cousin and his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivan is in jail. Why is she still afraid after he gets arrested?
That's a good point.
Yeah. So when you're seeing all this, like you said, she just all of a sudden completely flips on him.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that's strange to me is I'm not saying that a girlfriend wouldn't turn in a boyfriend or, you know, if I hypothetically murdered somebody and my wife turned me in, I could see that happening. But why would you go along with it all night long, do all this partying? I understand if she's afraid of him, I could see like, oh, I don't want to upset him, but you could go, oh, I don't feel good. Maybe we shouldn't go out tonight. You know what I mean? Like, why would you go over there and then go partying and do all this? It seems really strange to me.
Right. So, and that's what I'm getting at is when you look at this particular scenario, it's not just like she ratted him out.
Mm-hmm.
She supposedly went to the crime scene with him,
mm-hmm.
saw the dead body, saw the blood, and then went out partying with him. And then went on a trip with him to go visit her parents and went out of her way to show off this wedding ring
mm-hmm.
to everyone. But then rats him out and tells the police everything about, you know, everything and says that he did it. Like, what does that say? Like, what does your gut tell you just based on that scenario?
To me, it seems like she knows something
mm-hmm.
and she's trying to get it away from her.
Right.
And I'm not saying she's the killer, but she's very culpable in this, in my opinion.
Well, even in her own story, she's culpable to an extent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was thinking. We didn't really break down the podcast. So she's, in her version of events, she was told they were murdered, went to the scene, took items from the house, and then helped cover it up afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then changes her mind. So in either way, she has some kind of knowledge of it. But she's not even just like pushing it away from her. She's very, very directly pushing it at Ivan.
Yeah.
At her boyfriend.
What you just said, too, is you said that they went to the house and took some items.
Right.
Now, one of the things I did over this past week was I reached out to Liz Rose and talked to her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about the Rolex and how that actually comes to play a big part or could play a big part later.
Right.
What do we know about that Rolex?
Well, Matt and Liz know more about it than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mentioned in the Cousins by Blood podcast, and we're going to find out more about this in season 2, which should be coming out in about a month.
Okay.
But part of Amy's story, so James, the victim,
mm-hmm.
had a very $10,000 Rolex. She says, Ivan stole the Rolex, and then at some point decides to throw the Rolex out the car window, throws it away. Now, and this is a lot of her story fits with all these elements from the case, right? The Rolex was missing. So she says Ivan took it and threw it out the window. What we're told during season 1 is that the Rolex surfaced later.
Okay.
And I think all Matt said in the Cousins by Blood podcast was, we know for a fact that Ivan did not steal that Rolex.
Okay.
So my understanding is another family member had it and then brought it back and said, no, it's right here. We've had it the whole time. Which is another thing when you start looking at that one little piece,
mm-hmm.
you have to all of a sudden start questioning everything Amy said, because she made up a completely fabricated piece of evidence
mm-hmm.
about stealing this Rolex that never happened, but the Rolex was missing and wasn't there. Why is she making – so now can you believe anything else she's saying?
Yeah, and it does sound like that at some point after this, the police were aware that the Rolex was returned and never disclosed it.
Right. Yeah. And that's part of it. There's all kinds. So that's when I said the process, there was some shady prosecutor actions. There was, I mean, Ivan had a hard time. I mean, about as rough go of it as you can have if he's innocent. Even if he wasn't innocent, he still didn't get a fair trial, in my opinion. He had his defense counsel didn't put forth any evidence, didn't call any witnesses to prove his innocence.
Mm-hmm.
And then in his closing arguments, he conceded his guilt.
Really?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly how it shook out, but he was like, I think he said something to the extent of, I'm not saying he's not guilty. But you know, essentially, he was trying to sway the jury away from the death penalty.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm not saying he's not guilty. I'm saying there's enough question here to not put him to death. I mean, can you imagine being on a jury? How hard is that deliberation?
Yeah.
When the defense attorney just said, look, he's guilty.
That's ridiculous.
But then the prosecution, there were Brady violations like that. So the police later found the Rolex, knew that wasn't true, knew where it came from. And if I understand correctly, that was withheld from the defense at trial. So there's been all kinds of appeals based on this stuff, and Ivan just never had a good shake at it. He's had all his appeals denied all along the way.
Veronica says, I listened to the Cousins by Blood podcast. It seems like they have plenty of exculpatory evidence, and there was a Brady violation in the middle of the trial. They have it documented in the trial transcript. Why are there no appeals or motions currently in progress?
Well, the reason is his appeals have all been denied. And it's a Herculean task to overcome the burdens to overturn a conviction. And in this case, there are all these Brady violations and things. But what happens is, in order for a conviction to be, it's not like if the Brady violation is committed that your conviction's already automatically overturned. So the prongs of a Brady violation are that there was evidence, it was exculpatory, it was material, meaning it was, you know, important, like it absolutely made a difference in the case, and that it was withheld. But then the other prong of that that's not often discussed is the appeals courts have to determine that had that evidence been presented, that it likely would have made a difference in the outcome of the trial. And so what Ivan has working against him, and what he's had working against him throughout his entire appeals process, is that there was a monumental amount of evidence against him. And a lot of it, which appears to have been fabricated or planted not by the police, but by probably the real killer, if that's what happened. So you can say, so like the Rolex. Well, they at trial, they had witnesses saying that he stole this Rolex and threw it out the window. It comes out that the police actually knew he didn't steal it. Clear-cut Brady violation. It's material, it's exculpatory, and it was withheld. But then the appeals courts can say, okay, so let's say that was disclosed and the state was not able to use he stole the Rolex argument. There's still clothes with the victim's blood on his trash can. The victim's car is still parked outside of his house. He's still seed with the ring. And so they can deduce correctly, probably, that a jury would have still convicted without it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been the problem with everything along the way. The reason there's no current motions out or appeals happening right now is because he's exhausted all of them. He went through all his direct appeals. He went through his post-conviction appeals and appealed it all the way to, you know, he did his federal appeals all and then took it all the way to the Supreme Court, I believe in 2017, and the Supreme Court denied the case. They wouldn't hear the case. When that happens, you're done. His case is done. And that's why the petition on change.org is out there right now. Because there's been new legislation in the last several years that will allow death row inmates to present new evidence. So one thing that, and I don't have the specifics on all this, but one problem with this case and for Ivan's part is he's never had access to the evidence. You know, so there's DNA evidence on the pants, but we don't know, you know, is there other DNA we could find? Is the killer's DNA on there? You know, there's a whole litany of different items that could be tested for DNA evidence that he's never been given access to. So right now, all he's waiting for is for an execution date to be set. He has no more appeals unless he's given access to the evidence and is allowed to do further DNA testing. And if that testing provides evidence that someone else did it, which at this point, that's what it's going to take, is for evidence that someone else did it. And if that doesn't happen, he's going to be executed.
Now, it sounded like he got a stay of execution right now, but that could be lifted basically any moment, right?
He was granted a stay in 2011.
Okay.
His execution date was coming. I think it was within 30 days he was about to be executed, and a stay was granted because he had more appeals coming. So that stay, you know, they said we're going to wait on executing him until he has an opportunity to file more appeals. He's filed for ineffective assistance of counsel, for Brady violations. And the, where we sit right now, what's very scary about the situation we're currently in is that from 2011 to now is when he exhausted all those appeals. So right now there is no reason for the stay to still be in place because there's nothing else he can do unless new evidence is found. So at any time, the state could set it, they could set an execution date within, I think, 90 days when they set it, and he could be executed anytime if he doesn't get a chance to do new testing, which would obviously keep him, hopefully the state would keep him alive while they're doing new testing, and then after the results of that. Now, but that will be his last chance. If he gets new test, if they allow access to the evidence, allow him to do new testing, and if that comes back with nothing fruitful for his defense, then he'll be executed for sure. There's just nothing else they can do.
While we're on the topic of DNA, Christina says, I have no prior knowledge of Ivan Cantu's case prior to listening to the main episode this week, but I'm dying to know if the pants have ever been tested for the wearer's DNA. Clothing is a great source of DNA from epithelial cells, especially the waistband of pants. It would not be difficult to find out who was wearing those pants that had the victim's blood on them. As an anecdote, I actually had a case where we got DNA from the collar of a t-shirt left behind by the perpetrator of an armed robbery that showed my client was innocent.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. So the blood spots on the pants were tested for DNA, but that was it. And part of, if I'm understanding correctly, part of what Ivan is asking for is access to the pants to do exactly that, to test the waistband of the pants to see he was wearing them. You know, when this case occurred, you know, the conviction happened in 2001. At that point, you know, touch DNA wasn't a thing. And prior to that, you know, there's been so many more scientific advances. Of course, there's MVAC and stuff we talk about, but even we didn't even need that. You could literally just swab the waistband of the pants, which is this place that just collects sweat and skin cells and all kinds of stuff, and find out who was wearing them. And if they do that, this could end this entire nightmare. If they DNA test the waistband of those pants and it comes back and it's Ivan's DNA, well, then he did it. And do what I don't agree with execution ever anyway. But, you know, if that's what they're going to do, then so be it. But if they test it and it's anyone else's DNA, then he should be let out of prison.
Is this the same DNA lab that's from the Courtney's case? Do we know? Because it's the same time frame, the same basic area.
That's a really good question.
Because during that time frame is when they got in trouble for bad practices.
Right. That'd be worth checking out. That was the Fort Worth PD crime lab.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Dallas.
Yeah, but typically it's Dallas Fort Worth is what they talk about a lot.
Yeah, but they have separate crime labs. But I was thinking you were talking about Gene Screen or Kitzelmark, but who are private labs. Mm-hmm. And there's also the state crime lab where it could go. But no, it wouldn't have gone to Fort Worth because they only do DNA for Fort Worth. Even though people talk about the Dallas Fort Worth area though it's one thing, but they do have their own individual police departments and crime labs. Good question though.
Lauren says, have you ever thought about getting a PI license? It sounds like it would help solve some of your problems with access, especially in speaking to most of our subjects in prison.
I have. I've looked into it a few times, and I actually meant to get with Matt to see how he pulled off getting one. There's a couple issues that I've come across. One, in most states, in order to get a PI license, you have to have a degree in criminal justice or so many years as a law enforcement officer. Or you have to be sponsored by somebody for a certain period. You know, you have to be like an apprentice kind of. So with me not having any law enforcement experience and not having a law enforcement degree, there's literally no way for me to get one. But that's state by state. So Matt is working, I believe, in Louisiana now is where he's from and where he got his license. And he was able to somehow in just a matter of six months or a year take some classes to get certified as a private investigator. So I thought about looking into that, but if I understand correctly, your license as a private investigator is only valid for that state, I think. And maybe certain areas that allows you to do other work, but I don't think I could get a Louisiana PI license and then work with that license in Texas. Now, Matt did in Texas, but that doesn't necessarily mean he was using his license for access to certain things. So. Something that I've looked into for a long time. It seems like it's not possible. We've talked about with Allison at one point, if there was a way for Allison with the Innocence Project to sponsor me through, there's a certain program, I think in Texas where you can get sponsored by an attorney as an investigator. It's just tough to do.
Daniel says, can you share your theory about the ring? You mentioned having one, but didn't say much about it.
Well, it's not really anything real complex, but there's a couple things in this case that are just anecdotal behavioral analysis things that caught my attention. One was listening to the phone calls of Ivan with his mom trying to help investigate things. If you listen to Cousins by Blood, you'll hear it. We talked about the Dallas Cowboys tickets for one. So he is for weeks harassing his mother to find, and I think this is one of our questions, Mike, so I'll just cover that right now too. Somebody asked about if the Cowboys tickets were ever discovered. So Ivan had a set of Dallas Cowboys tickets that were with a magnet on his refrigerator. And after the police had come to execute the warrant, when they came, the tickets weren't there, and they weren't found. And the tickets were for, I don't know when the game was, a week or two or whenever it was after the game or after the murders happened. It was after Ivan was arrested. So Ivan's theory that he explained to his mother is that whoever actually committed the crime, whoever's framing him, came into his apartment after he was gone when he was in Arkansas, planted the pants and the socks and stuff in there. And he says he thinks they took the Dallas Cowboys tickets. And so he's after his mother to find out, you know, the person they got the tickets from constantly. And he's just like frantic and desperate for her to find these tickets, because he said whoever took those tickets are the same people that planted the evidence. And all they have to do then is to go to the Cowboys, you know, stadium, I guess, and try to look at surveillance video and find out who was sitting in those seats. And if they can find out who was sitting in those seats, those are the people that took the tickets. So, you know, makes sense. But you're listening to him frantically insisting that she has to find them. They have to get with the Dallas Cowboys and find out who was sitting in those seats. Now, as it turns out later, they eventually find those tickets. They weren't on the fridge. They were like in a drawer somewhere or something at the apartment. So there's nothing that could be done about it. But for me, someone who really pays a lot of attention to behavior, was like, why would he be so insistent? You could hear it in his tone, in his voice. He was convinced. He himself was convinced that someone took those tickets and was in those seats and that would exonerate him. Turned out not to be the case, but that was just something that behaviorally made me think, okay, I really think that he didn't do this. He's really convinced someone else did it. Along that same line comes the ring theory. So there's a few things that play in here. It was said repeatedly and confirmed by Amy Betcher's father or stepfather that this trip to Arkansas had been planned for a couple weeks. They knew they were going to Arkansas on this day, and that happens to be the morning after the murders. So was that a coincidence, or were the murders planned to happen right before they were supposed to leave? That's just something to think about. But the ring, so Ivan says that Amy came to him with a ring that a friend of hers had given her, and she wore it to tell people or to convince her father or her parents that they were engaged so that they would be able to sleep in the same bed at her house. That's what Ivan's story is. And he said the ring was very clearly a cheap cubic zirconia ring. And then Amy was showing it off to everyone. But then when they got to her parents' house, Ivan wanted her parents to see the ring. It makes a big deal, but at least that's Amy's side of the story. That's what happened. My theory was very simple, that because of the ring, I think that's a good indicator that Ivan's girlfriend was a large part of trying to set him up for this crime. That she was going, there were witnesses that said she was going out of her way to show people the ring. According to Ivan, she's the one that brought the ring to him, and she's the one that was showing everyone the ring when they were out at the bars and stuff that night. And I think that was, the theory was not even a big theory. It was just that I think that is an indication behaviorally to me that the setup, like this was planned. Like going to the bars, doing all that stuff that night, making sure that she wanted to, I mean, think about, why would she want to put the ring on right after the murders?
Mm-hmm.
But she puts it on right after these murders, and then she's going around showing everyone that she has it. And the only theory I had was that this was, A, the murders were planned, And that's again, that's if what Ivan's saying is true, which could not be, you know, that she's the one that had the ring. Maybe Ivan actually stole the ring, whatever it was. The ring was never recovered, by the way, later. But it's an indicator to me that the murders were planned and that the plan was to set up Ivan from Jump Street. So whoever killed them, whether it was Amy, and I doubt it was actually Amy that did it, but whoever killed them gave the ring to Amy and told her to do this, or she was a part of a plan to do this. You know, again, this is a lot of if there was a cover-up, and that's why there was such a big issue about the ring, and it was pointed out. It's just a weird thing to be pointed out. It's a strange thing in any scenario, but definitely a weird thing in this instance that she has the victim's ring on her and is making a point to show a bunch of people. To me, it was just an indicator that she's in on whoever killed them, or is part of it. Maybe voluntarily, or maybe by coercion or by force, is helping to point the finger at Ivan, and the ring was part of that plan.
Sophie says, when did Amy B. get the gun, bullets, etc. to plant under Tawny's sofa cushion? Did she go off alone at some point? I'm presuming that the gun at Tawny's was the actual murder weapon.
Well, there's three possibilities with that evidence being found at Tawny's house. So Amy and Ivan stayed at her house the night, I believe it was the night before he got arrested. And then after he's arrested, Amy and Tawny are together again. I don't know if it was at her house. So the night before, when they're there, either Amy or Ivan planted that evidence there. As far as when they got it, I mean, again, it depends on what you think about the case. If Ivan's the killer, first of all, I'll say it makes no sense. I mean, they made a big deal on the podcast and in her interview, in Tawny's interview, that he would never put the gun and stuff there because that's where the cat sits, which I think is horseshit. I mean, she might believe that, but I mean, I don't think that's a reason not to plant evidence somewhere. But what it doesn't make sense is that if Ivan did this, he's taking steps to be careful in denying that he did everything, always maintaining his evidence, supposedly throwing it by Amy's story, throwing the watch out the window. There's all this stuff that the ring's gone, but then he leaves the murder. And keep in mind, if he had the murder weapon still, and the drugs or money, whatever it was, he had it with him on his person during a road trip all the way from Texas to Arkansas and back. If he wanted to hide that weapon somewhere, to ditch it somewhere where it will never be found, I mean, literally anywhere. He went across the Mississippi fucking river, mm-hmm. or was right there near it in Arkansas. You know, he could have dumped it in the river. He could have any street. I mean, if you throw it in the trash somewhere, you know, again, this is not 2020 forensics. These are the 90s forensics. He could have thrown that gun and stuff anywhere. Why does he hang on to it and take it? If the whole intention is to get rid of it until he gets all the way back and then put it under a couch cushion of someone whose house they stayed at. So it's very, at some point she's going to find it. So that makes no sense to me. The other possibility is going along with what we said about the ring, that Amy was a part of framing Ivan for this murder from the very beginning, and that she had it the whole time and waited for her opportunity and then stuck it under the couch cushion, you know, when Ivan and Tawny were in a different room. Or I mean, there's any time she could have had it with her the entire time. Would have had, either one of them would have had to have had those items with them the entire time. And then when you hear Tawny say that she gives Amy a ride to the airport, and then Amy gives her money and gives her $1,500, which whether Ivan did it or she was just a part of it, it sounds like there was quite a bit of money stolen from the victim's house. So mm-hmm. somehow that would filter back to her. But she gives her $1,500 for a ride to the airport, which is nuts, but then tells her, go look in your house and make sure Ivan didn't stash anything. And I don't remember if she told her the exact spot, but I think she said look under the couch cushions or the chair cushions to make sure Ivan didn't stash anything. And then sure enough, there's on a silver platter the murder weapon is all right there.
So even if Ivan did it, Amy knows something, clearly.
Yeah, well, I mean, if according to her story, yeah, she went there and looked at the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so and that's what makes this tricky, is because whether her story is true or not, it's either true or she's lying and someone else, she's working with someone else to cover this up. In either case, she has guilty knowledge of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it tricky because it's not like, you know, one word, it's not like she's in one scenario, she was with Ivan and didn't know he did it, but here's some evidence towards him. She's like, no, I know for a fact he did it. I saw him at the house and all that. And if that's not true, that means then she got that knowledge from somewhere else. So it makes it tricky, but it just pointing her right back to, oh, go look at it right there, instead of just going to the police and say, you know, it doesn't make sense. To me, it looks an awful lot like Amy was a big part of setting Ivan up. And again, behaviorally speaking, when you go back to the fact that after he's arrested, when according to her story, he acted alone in murdering James and Amy, and she says she's leaving because she's still scared that something might happen to her. That's leakage, as we call that. She's leaking out knowledge that she's not telling us, because if she knows Ivan's the sole killer, there is no reason to be afraid once he's already locked up. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 per month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. And like our Facebook page, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING. And Zach can be found at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
This has been Truth and Justice.
You said I can't talk. Let's go. Ad break.
No, I'm good.
Producer, do you like the way that
it's fine.
Rolled in?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting corny now with them. Hey, everybody.
Yeah, hey, guys.
It's not real. It doesn't sound real.
We're not actors.
Hey, everybody.
Howdy ho.